Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Manhattan Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I'm Kathy Hedge. I'm a member of this organization, and I want to welcome you here. For those of you who grew up surrounded by books and poetry, to those who discovered your own path lately, or those who just read or just read when you must, you are welcome here. If you thrive on mysteries, encyclopedias, science fiction, philosophy, or e-books, you are welcome here, or none of the above, you are welcome here. No matter who you are or who you wish to become, you are welcome here. So please join us today for our celebration. We are a fellowship of Unitarian Universalists who meet to express our individual beliefs and religious convictions. We belong to the national organization, the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, and are members of the UUA's Prairie Star District. The Unitarian Universalist Association has no creed, no prophet, or sacred book, but we agree to seven principles that are listed here on the back of your bulletin. What we believe. Visitors, you're invited to join us after the service. So we'll get together out in the narthex here or just any place where you'd like to be for coffee, lemonade, and chatting with fellows. And if you are a guest here and you would like to introduce yourself, we would love to have you do so. But just please wait for a microphone. So do we have any guests here who would like to be introduced or to introduce themselves? It's not a requirement. Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, reading is the gateway to new worlds. It's the way to discover paths that are otherwise closed to us. And that is why the American slaves were denied the right to read. They had to develop codes for survival and to escape to freedom. And in their honor and for all of those who are still denied literacy, let us join together and sing number 152, Follow the Drinking Gourd. And please stand as you are able. Number 152. This is from Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, just about as time to do a first torch. Tonight, someone had slipped. This woman, for those of you who don't know the book, it's they are book burners. to save the minds of the community they believe. But now, tonight, someone had slipped. This woman was spoiling the ritual. The men were making too much noise, laughing, joking, to cover her terrible, accusing silence below. She made the empty rooms roar with accusations and shake down a fine dust of guilt that was sucked in their nostrils as they plunged about. It was neither cricket nor correct. Montag felt an immense irritation. She shouldn't be here on top of everything. Books bombarded his shoulders, his arms, his upturned face. A book lit almost obediently like a white pigeon in his hands, fluttering, wings fluttering in the dim, wavering light. A page hung open, and it was like a snowy feather, the words delicately painted thereon. In all the rush and fervor, Montag had only an instant to read a line, but it blazed in his mind for the next minute as if stamped there with fiery steel. Time has fallen asleep in the afternoon sunshine. He dropped the book. Immediately, another fell into his arms. Montag, up here. Montag's hand closed like a mouth, crushed the book with that wild devotion, with an insanity of mindlessness to his chest. The men above were hurling shovelfuls of magazines into the dusty air. They fell like slaughtered birds, and the woman stood below like a small girl among the bodies. Montag had done nothing. His hand had done it all. His hand, with a brain of its own, with a conscience and a curiosity in each trembling finger, had turned thief. Now it plunged the book back under his arm, pressed it tight to sweating armpit, rushed out empty with a magician's flourish. Look here, innocent, look. He gazed, shaken, at the white hand. He held it way out as if he were farsighted. He held it close as if he were blind. Montag, he jerked about. Don't stand there, idiot. The book lay like great mounds of fishes left to dry. The men danced and slipped and fell over them. Titles glittered, their golden eyes falling, gone. Kerosene. They pumped the cold fluid from the numeral 451 tanks strapped to their shoulders. They coated each book. They pumped rooms full of it. For the light that art and knowledge brings to our lives, we light this chalice. Now is the time when we share the joys and concerns of our lives. So if you have things you'd like to share with the fellowship, please do, but wait for the microphone before speaking.
Hi, Ann Marchin, and I wanted to tell you my youngest daughter of four, Marjorie, was married in Kansas City on the 27th of June. So.
Mark Mayfield, we are now the proud owners of a new puppy, 12-week-old puppy we got from the Humane Association. His name is Uno.
Larry Weaver, my joy is that my daughter and her family from Germany, including two grandchildren, are arriving tomorrow. I'm really looking forward to spending a couple of weeks with them. I'll be absent the next two Sundays.
my name is Mark Long, 2127 Northview Drive. My family just put out a little free library in front of our house. Anyone can come pick up free books. And you can check that out at a website called Little Free Library. And so you can pick up books there.
Yay!
Hi, Kathleen Oldfather. We just returned from a trip to Minnesota where we had my father's memorial in Mankato, Minnesota. He passed away 6 months ago, but we had a great family reunion and another several nice days in Minnesota. And then I wanted to announce that I found out this morning that Les Frazier was flown to Mayo Clinic, which is what he was hoping to do, to have his back looked at. So quite an accomplishment. It's going to be a little tricky to keep up with him and figure out how he's doing, but we'll try. So keep a good thought.
If you read the Manhattan Mercury, you might notice the editorial this morning, which concerns a friend of ours who comes here once in a while.
A while ago, I had felt a calling, and after long deliberation, I finally decided to commit myself to seminary training to become ordained clergy in the Carilion Wiccan faith, to become clergy for my priestesshood.
Hi, Molly McGoy. This is kind of a thank you to Pat and Anna and everybody who did the service two weeks ago when we did the intertribal dance at the end. I can't tell you how many times I've thought of this moment. We were all marching around and doing everything, and Kristen Corwin, who's not here today, her son Landon was trying to be a good kid and was in and out a little bit and patient and everything, but he didn't want to dance, but he watched his mom dance, and when we were all sitting down afterwards, he said, "Did you have a good time, Mommy?" And it was just the sweetest moment, and I just can't stop thinking about it. It was really sweet. So thank you all for helping make that moment happen.
Thank you very much. And for those joys that are left and concerns that are left unsaid, we hold you in our hearts. We do have one announcement. The Manhattan Alliance for Peace and Justice is showing a film, The Invisible War, Tuesday evening at 7:15 at the First United Methodist Church. The detail is in the newsletter that's on the coffee sales table, or you can see Ann Cowan in the back row here. The Invisible War is a documentary on sexual assault in the military. We do have other announcements that are listed in our bulletin, including our musicale coming up. So that's very exciting. Okay, so children, would you please come join me for a conversation? Thank you for coming up. Pardon me? William's handing out the microphone today. Doing a nice job of it, too. Well, thank you all for coming up here and joining me, because I'd like to have a conversation with you. And we'll also share the microphone, okay? So one of my grandson's favorite books is by Mo Willems, and it's called We Are in a Book. Have any of you read that one? We Are in a Book? Well, if you haven't, it's one that you need to read. And I was going to read it today, but I decided I'd rather listen to what you have to say. So, but in We Are in a Book, there is an elephant and a pig. And they're having a nice little conversation, and then they realize that someone's looking at them. And the someone who is looking at them is you, the reader. And they get very excited to be noticed. And they are very excited that they are in a book. But then they decide to start playing. And they believe that they can make the reader who's reading the book talk to them. What does this say?
Banana.
Oh, I did it. I made you say banana. Let's see if we can get them to say it again.
Banana.
Ooh, wonderful. So the best thing that happens in We Are in a Book is that when this elephant and this pig are getting us involved in saying bananas, we are getting drawn into that book so much that we feel like we're standing right there with them playing this game. And that, to me, is the kind of book I love to read that makes me feel that right at that time, I am with those people, I am in that place, and I'm sitting there wondering at the same time, what's going to happen next? So what I would like to ask you is if you've had books that or stories that have given you that feeling that you are right there at that time. And what I want to do is have you think for just 30 seconds about your favorite story. It doesn't have to be a written story. It can be something that somebody has told you. And I want you to think about the kind of book or that kind of story that gives you the feeling that you could read it over and over and over again. Even if you had the words memorized, you just want it read again, or you want to look at them again. And then if you'd like, I'd love to hear what stories you have. So let's take about 30 seconds and just think of your favorite stories, and then we'll pass the mic around to anyone who wants to share what a favorite story is of theirs. Okay, ready? 30 seconds. Some of you, it doesn't even take 30 seconds. That's great.
Thomas the Train.
Oh.
Thomas the Train.
Ooh, that's a good one. All right. What else do we have? What's other favorite? Why do you like Thomas the Train so much?
Because they hoo and they ride people.
Oh, yes. That's very nice of them to do, isn't it? Okay. What other favorites do we have here?
Cars 2. Harry Potter.
Harry Potter, even though I'm 7, I really like it.
Do you have a favorite book?
A Thomas the Train book.
Thomas the Train is very popular. Yes, very good. And he's also very kind. I like Thomas. What else?
Jake? Spider-Man.
Batman.
What else do we have here? What are some other favorite stories? Ladies, you're looking very shy, but we want to hear what you have to say, too. Okay.
Superman.
What else?
Spider-Man.
Iron Man.
Dr. Seuss. Mostly everyone.
Mostly everyone. I agree. Okay, let's give these ladies a chance, and then we'll get back to you fellows. Okay? What else? They're just looking like, please leave me alone, Kathy. But I know they're thinking about it. Okay? What else? Okay. Well, I have a lady up here that I know. She has favorite books. Okay? Ha ha ha. What's your favorite story?
She doesn't want to say it herself, but she told me Stella Luna, book about a bat.
Oh, I love Stella Luna, the little fruit bat. Oh, yes, that's a beautiful story. Great pictures, too. She did some other books, too, besides Stella Luna, really beautiful. Something squeegee or Ouija or some little creature, another little creature. It's very good. Okay, what else? Okay, we do have another. I'll be back. Okay, what else?
Adventures.
Adventures. Love adventures.
Iron Man.
I think we have a theme going on here, okay? And one last.
Iron Man!
Power Rangers and Ninja Turtles.
Okay, it sounds like we got a bunch here. Okay, well, Leah, I'm sorry, we're going to have to... The theme, she knows the theme, which is...
Superheroes.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm going to be asking you maybe privately what are books that you really love, because I write books and I want to write a book that you want to read. Okay? So, but for now, we'll let you go because we have an exciting day in RE today. So, shall we sing our young people out here?
Go now, peace. Go now, peace. Go now, peace.
Thank you, Renee. That was beautiful. Well, I'll bet that if I asked you what books or readings have touched your lives, you'd be able to tell me, at least if I was patient enough to listen, to wait for you. But maybe you even remember how old you were when you first heard or read that piece. You might even remember a line or two. Most likely, your house has bookshelves or e-readers, or newspapers and magazines scattered about, and very much how lucky we are. When I was in college, I read two books written 120 years apart that describe the struggles of two black men learning to read. One was Frederick Douglass. He was denied the right to read by slavery and by law. The second, Malcolm X, was denied by poverty and poor schooling. But both were transformed and were transformative once they found the power of books. In a perverse way, the slave owners were right. If you deny a person knowledge, Then you can keep them down. Unfortunately for many of our poor, these barriers still exist. There's Dr. Alfred Tatum at the University of Chicago in Illinois, University of Illinois in Chicago. And he has done research with incarcerated youth, predominantly African-American males, but not exclusively. But most can't read, and our prison population as a whole, most can't read. And one piece of research that he did, he discovered that when he asked the young men to list the books in their lives or the stories in their lives that they will always remember and that they will refer to in times of need, he called them their textual lineage. Most of them couldn't write any. Not one. Not one piece of one written piece that touched their lives. Nothing. No favorite stories, no characters, either fictitious or real, no mysteries to ponder or adventures to share, no history of the men and women who were birthed into adversity and then struggled to overcome that. There was no piece of writing that showed them in a safe way the way out of the traps that circumstances and their choices built. So Dr. Tatum took a new tack, and he focused on direct teaching of difficult but meaningful literature. If any of you have ever picked up an easy reader book, the kind of things that some people torture poor readers with, they are the most boring pieces of work you could ever see. There's not an exciting word in the entire thing. And they also, or worksheets. Usually students who really struggle are diagnosed pretty early as struggling readers, and they get relegated to reading classes. And people are really trying to change the way that system works, but especially in our poor schools, oftentimes that reading instructor is someone who's not trained, often someone who's been brought in from a teaching program that uses college graduates that don't have degrees, and have, so it's their first year of even trying to teach, and oftentimes they are the ones who are supposed to work with the struggling readers. But Dr. Tatum, by this direct teaching of exciting material, meaningful material, really transformed some of their lives. And so I'm thankful that that those young men started to make connections, and he goes around the country and talks about this, and so it's not just an isolated situation. But the most important thing when he was interviewed by PBS, the most important thing he said is that through that reading, they're not reading for their class, or they're not reading for their race. What they're reading for is reading for themselves and reading for empowerment of themselves, not for their grades, not for their teachers, not for their parents, but for themselves. So I'm thankful that they had a chance and that I had a chance to meet Dr. Tatum and hear his transformative message, because there are millions of young people out there who have a right, and that is the right to live a million lives through the imagination and the knowledge of what is in books. So today we're celebrating the pieces of writing that have drawn us into that new world, a new place, and held us there like Montag's white pigeon fluttering in his hand. So one way I would like to celebrate this, the power of books, is to share with you the piece that I wrote recently about my grandson and the books in our lives. It's called The Wonder of Words. One of the greatest pleasures in life is watching someone begin to read and enjoy words. It happens so fast, like magic. Back in November, my grandson was accomplished with his name, a few phrases, and lots of words on sight. Now, just half a year later, he can pick up most items, books, comics, cereal boxes, directions, menus, and figure out most of the words and the rest from context. He sits on the couch, wrapped up in his new Garfield book, and studies it intently. While I watch him, I wonder, of all the words swirling around in his world, which ones will he look back to in 50 years? Who are the authors who have created the images, phrases, poems, and scenes that he will use when choices that he must make are murky, maddening, or dangerous? Right now, he refers to Piggy, an elephant, who learned to share ice cream. That's another one of their fun books. The Magic School Bus and How Poop is Made. And the Lorax, who saves the Truffula trees. But in 5, 10, 15 years, will he discover writers who will touch his soul the way that others have touched mine? And I can't wait for the time when the time is right to share the pieces that have changed my life. And I have some of them listed up here. When I was 7, I read Gulliver's Travels. And my uncle got it for free because he bought a bag of groceries. They were giving out Gulliver's Travels. So that was my birthday present from him. And I understood the words, but not the concepts. I just couldn't figure out how they put out the fire in the Lilliput just because they brought Gulliver a whole bunch of barrels of ale. I just couldn't figure that out. I was mystified. But when I finished the book, I was really proud of myself because the type was really small. It wasn't a very expensive book. It had tiny, tiny type. And in my 7-year-old mind, I just rationalized it that was because I was reading about Lilliputians. And so that's why why it was little. When I was 10, I sneaked a peek at the medical book that my mom had in the house. It was the only book in the whole house that she told us not to read. Okay, so of course I opened it up, and that was when I first remember one of my tendencies. My tendency is if I open up a book that I'm not supposed to read, or I'm not sure that I should read simply because I don't think it's my taste, or because it's just has a gross background, I will invariably open it up to the very worst page in the whole book. And so I open it up to this picture of a woman with a horrific goiter. I mean, it was like clear out to here. Oh, I can still remember it. I can still remember what it looked like. And boy, I never looked at that book again. So by now I have a very nice science life body book that Thurston and I, he loves to look at. He loves to look at all the oozy kind of things that are in the book. And I still remember that goiter picture. So there's one in there too, but it's a small one, you know. So, but I realized at that point that when my mom censored something, it was only for something that she knew that we wouldn't like. When I was 11, I read my brother's copy of Lord of the Flies, and I realized that I could hate a book. I still do. It happened again when I was 17 with The Scarlet Letter. In 32 years of teaching English, I was so happy that I didn't have to teach either of those two books. Now, the quality of the writing was fantastic. It was the concepts that I just couldn't abide. So, and this is a side shoot. When I was a freshman in high school in Louisiana, honest to goodness, this is a true story, and I may have told it before. I had read The Scarlet Letter by that time, and I made the straight A honor roll. And to celebrate the straight A honor roll, they called us all into the principal's office. I think there were about 10 of us, and they pinned red A letters, and I had to wear all day. Honest to goodness, I couldn't believe it. Like, do you guys not read? So, anyway. It's amazing. It's just amazing. I was so embarrassed. I took it off as soon as I got home from school, that's for sure. But with 1984, when I read that, I realized that a government that seemed benign, seemed to be doing the right things for you, could destroy you. And that books did not always have happy endings. When I read Grapes of Wrath, I learned that the people in our community that some of my peers scorned as Okies, I realized that they also had brilliance, passion, and they deserved justice. In my town where I grew up, the transients were the very, very poorest people in the area. It was dreadful. And so Grapes of Wrath really changed that perception. With Emily Dickinson, I learned that a shy, plain woman could stay inside her cloistered walls, but her words would not. From Ray Bradbury's Dandelion Wine, I laughed along with the shoe salesman who closed up shop so we could run with the boy who bought new tennis shoes. So both of them put on new tennis shoes, and the little boy is a great salesman, convinces them that that's what you have, that's what really makes summer. And then that's the way I discovered that you really never have to grow old. And I think that's the piece that touches me the most as I watch my little boy curled up on the couch giggling about a fat cat and spider sandwiches. So, thank you. Now, Jennifer Bryan's going to share with us. Jennifer Bryan, did I say that right? Okay.
Dean Young is the author. The poem is Chapped Lips. The problem with childhood is it's wasted on children. Look at them all strung up together, not being run over by the bus. They're not nearly scared enough. Just look how they color. They think they'll be Matisse's forever. They think you can just get up in the morning and put on your velvet shoes. And they're small. If they were any smaller, you could stick them to the ceiling like flies. But no, they keep lofting back down like defeated balloons. But what do they know of defeat? What do they know of the broken bathysphere? In their little hats and mittens, truly they look absorbent. But just try using one of them to wipe up a spill. And there are so many spills. Spills that make ducks sick. Spills that dissolve railroads. Spills we don't even know what they're doing. But they're sure doing it. Try explaining that to a child, and all you get is la, la, la. Try getting one to sit for an hour with her face in her hands. They remember almost nothing, so what they forget could be forgiven by anyone. They don't pay taxes. They're completely devoid of pubic hair. Dean Young. Well, poetically, this poem, I think it just struck me because it made me realize you can say anything. I mean, spills that make ducks sick. Who writes that? Dean Young does, and he's got some wonderful stuff. And then there's a lot of great rhythm in this poem, too. I mean, but no, they keep lofting back down like defeated balloons. So there's something really fun to say about it. So when you go home tonight, or this afternoon, say they keep lofting back down like defeated balloons over and over, and you might get happy, I don't know. But on the personal side of this poem, it kind of reminded me of something that happened. I enrolled in a community college drama class in it's about 1991. And we were supposed to share the stories that had made us, the fearful stories from our life. And so there's about 12 to 20, you know, young adults in this community college class, and all got up. And they were talking about, and I'd been in college already for 3 years, but they were talking about, you know, being chased by police and being drunk as all get out, and, you know, all these stories. And I got up there and told this story about how this, when I was about 7, this fireman came in and showed us a video of how the TV might explode in the middle of the night. And I had many nightmares about that particular. So anyway, what I'm trying to say is when I realized that this was the poem that most affected my life, and, you know, if affected me, and I love this poem, I thought, oh, God, you know, I'm going to have to share a poem about ducks throwing up, and that's my favorite poem. And I guess maybe the way that it changes my life might be a little bit right now, I don't know. I would say that in looking around my surroundings, I didn't find much probably I wanted to base my personality on growing up. I think of a lot of it was based on Raggedy Ann and the Johnny Gruel books, and maybe Big Bird from Sesame Street, I think. So maybe the way that this poem changes my life is to realize, you know, kind of concretize that kind of childlike, childish ways of my general life, a lot of it, and say, well, maybe it's time to listen to some other poems, too. So I will be glad to hear. I do think it's a wonderful poem, though, and I hope you all look up Dean Young. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Christopher Renner. When I think about books, I think first you need to know that I went to a Catholic, two-room Catholic school for elementary education. And in first grade, we had Sister Mary Gregory. And Sister Mary Gregory's, one of her joys of life was to break yardsticks over disobedient children. And one of the things she liked to break yardsticks over was when people would mispronounce words while reading orally in front of the class. Now, if any of you can remember back to your grade schools of the joys of reading orally in front of the class, you were probably as petrified as I was that first day. And in the little reader, which was David and Anne were the primary characters, of course, I had this word David, which I'd never seen before in my life. Needless to say, I had a yardstick broke across my back the first day I tried to read. Damage done for the next 16 years of my life, so to speak. When I was in college, finally, I had a professor lean over one day and says, "Do you have trouble reading?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, there's going to be this course." And I learned to read my senior year in college, finally, after Sister Mary Gregory had done her work for 2 years in first and second grade. And so I became a very vivacious reader then for a period of my life. The joys of using public transportation is you have time to read. In the United States, we have to drive cars. And I tried the books on tape, but nothing stayed in when I wasn't reading it. So I'm not a big books on tape guy. But I remember in Italy in particular, I read ravenously. I probably read anywhere from 60 to 100 books a year while I was in Italy. I'm lucky if I get through 5 or 6 here in the United States because I'm always driving a car versus being able to sit and read a book. Well, there are some books that really speak to my life. Martin Luther King's Letter from a Birmingham Jail is probably the thing that most stirred my soul when I first read that about the whole racial issues. Carlson McCullough's The Heart is a Lonely Hunter is a fabulous read that brings into all sorts of questions U.S. economic policy towards the poor, trade unionism, organizing workers, deaf people and their role in our U.S. society, and an odd relationship between two people of the same sex, not really clearly defined in the book. But there's all sorts of other things in that book, too. It's a very historical novel in a certain sense. I would say The Grapes of Wrath is well worth the read also if you really want to question U.S. economic policy. There's other things that also speak to me. In the early 80s, I was introduced to an Indian philosopher, Jay Krishnamurti. And the book I'm going to read from today is The Awakening of Intelligence. And this is probably a passage that by far has affected my life and part of the reason why I was here. And those of you who've been around in this congregation for the past 15 years, you will have heard me read this at a similar discussion of books some 13 years ago. But take a deep breath, clear your mind, and listen. You know the past is the unconscious. You know what the unconscious is. Don't go back to Freud or Jung or all the rest of those people, but look at it for yourself and find out, not through empiricalism, but actually observe it. The past in you is your tradition, the books that you have read, the racial inheritance as the Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, Christian, and all the rest of it, and the culture in which you have lived, the temples, the beliefs that you have been handed down from generation to generation. This constitutes the propaganda to which you have been subjected, your propaganda. You are slaves to the propaganda of 5,000 years, and the Christian is a slave to the propaganda of 2,000 years. He believes in Jesus Christ, and you believe in Krishna, or whatever you do believe in, as the communists believe in something else. What are the results of propaganda? Do you realize what it means? Words, the influence of others? So there is nothing whatsoever original. And to find out the origin of anything, we must have order. Order that can only come about when there is a sensation of total disorder in oneself, because all of us, at least those who have ever a little seriousness and thoughtfulness and earnest, must have asked whether there is anything sacred at all, anything holy. Of course, the answer is that the temple, the mosque, or the church is not holy, is not sacred, nor the images herein. I do not know if you have experimented with yourself, but take a piece of a stick and put it on a mantelpiece, and every day put a flower in front of it, give it a flower, and put it in front of the flower and repeat the words Coca-Cola. Amen. Om. It doesn't matter what word you use, any word you like. Listen, don't laugh it off, do it and you will find out. If you do it, after a month, you will see how holy it has become. You have identified yourself with that stick, with that piece of stone, or with that piece of idea, and you have made it into something sacred, holy. But it is not. You have given it a sense of holiness out of your fear, out of the constant habit of this tradition, giving yourself over, surrendering yourself to something which you consider holy. The image in the temple is no more holy than a piece of rock by the roadside. So it is very important that you find out what is really sacred, what is really holy, and if there is such a thing at all. You know, man has spoken of this throughout the centuries, seeking something that is imperishable, not that it is created by the mind, that it is holy in itself, something that is never touched by the past. Man is always seeking that. And man, seeking that, not finding it, has invented religion, organized belief. A serious man has to find out, not through some rock, temple, or idea, but he has to find out what is really, truly, everlastingly sacred. If you cannot find it, you will not always be cured. You will always be cruel. You will always be in conflict. And if you will, this evening, listen, perhaps you may come upon it, not through the speaker, not through his words, not through his statements, but you may come upon it when there is discipline through the understanding of disorder. When you watch, see what is disorder. The very seeing of disorder demands attention. Please do not follow. Please do follow this. You know, for most of us, discipline is a drill, as for the soldier, drill, 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 from morning until night, so that there is nothing but slavery to a habit. And that is what we call discipline. Suppression, control, that is deadly. That is not discipline at all. Discipline is a living thing. It has its own beauty, its own freedom, and this discipline comes naturally when you know how to look at a tree, how to look at a face of your wife or your husband, when you can see the beauty of a tree or a sunset, see it, to look at the sky, the glow of it, the beauty of the leaves against that glow, the orange color, the depth of that color, the swiftness of that color, see it. To see it, you must give your whole attention to it. And to give your whole attention has its own discipline. And you don't want any other kind of discipline. So that thing, that attention that is a living thing, moving and vital, this attention itself is virtue. Now, I read this passage riding on a commuter train in Naples, Italy, clanging along. But we were stopped because when I arrived in Italy in 1982, there was a period in the Naples area of Bratti sees me. That's the opposite of Earth going this way. The Earth goes up and down. And so, needless to say, going through tunnels where there had been all sorts of bratty sees me was always a scary adventure. But I was sitting there reading this, and I reread it several times. And I still remember looking out the window and looking at this steel girder they had put up at the entryway of a tunnel that they were checking to make sure it was safe to drive the train through. And I was thinking, well, that's sort of a virtue in itself, to be able to sit there and trust that that steel girder is going to hold up. But there's a lot of things that speak to me in this passage, and mostly is the concept of what is sacredness. So often, being raised in the Roman Catholic tradition, I was told that objects were sacred, and all sorts of finesse about what you do with those objects. And then you come to a period in your life where you question all that symbolism, and you look for new symbolism. And what do you replace that symbolism with? Unfortunately, in our culture, we replace it with consumerism. And I was looking for something other than consumerism. And so in reading this and other books by J. Krishnamurti, I think, really formed the foundation of a period of how I still look at life in a lot of ways. You can make anything you want holy, and we have lots of holy cows running around. And people treat them with great reverence, be it football or the K-State new football stadium. For example, that's a holy cow, you know. But what is really being needed in our community and what do we really need every day to survive often goes unmet. There's a lot of poverty that we don't address. There's a lot of falseness in media that we don't address. And we just continue to listen to the propaganda. So I think this chapter still speaks today as clearly as it did in 1982 when I first read it. And it constantly calls me to look beyond the sacred cows that we have walking on our streets.
Thank you, Chris. Diane Barker's not going to be able to be with us today. She sends her regrets. And so our next person that we get to hear from... Diane? No? Oh, Diane! Yay! All right. You sweetheart. Do you want to just listen or did you want to come up?
Well, why don't you save me till the last?
Okay.
That's okay.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. Thank you. Well, thank you, Charlie and June. I appreciate you pointing her out. So, Charlie.
Okay, I'm Charlie Kempthorne. I actually wrote this out. I didn't mean to, but I did. I'm an old man. I guess that's a duh. I'm 75. I joined the fellowship in 1983, 30 years ago. For years, Brock Dale and I, this was in the old sanctuary, the famous Deeds Not Creeds sanctuary named for Ines Alsop, one of our early benefactors who would rise during the question period of the meeting, which probably took up most of the meeting, and say in a quavering voice, she then being about the age I am now, deeds, not creeds, in response to some real or imagined inquiry about what Unitarians stood for. That's an aside. I started to say that Brock and I were the only people who would stand up and read a poem almost every Sunday. Brock was a physicist who loved poetry as much as he loved physics, perhaps more, who once told me he spent 10 years doing almost nothing but reading poetry. But Brock was a busy and productive man, it should be noted. That's an aside, too. At my age, everything's an aside. Life kind of takes place in a parenthesis. I was about to say that reading poems aloud to this group or any other, to a class or by myself at midnight, has been a lifelong thing. Well, reading has been. My mother taught me to read. My family cared about words. Words, 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 as old Hamlet said. My parents weren't teachers. My father was a doctor. My mother was an honors graduate from a high school in Indianapolis where she wasn't allowed in the honors society because they thought she was Jewish. Her last name was Isaacs, so the Jewishness was reasonable, a reasonable assumption by any pack of Christians. My mother insisted she was not Jewish. And allowed our heathenry to shine through. But years later, I was told by a Jewish friend, a knowledgeable man who had married the girl I had my very first date with, Irene Miller of Miller Ranch notability, that in fact I was a Jew if I wanted to be and could walk right into temple. My IQ shot up 20 points, though my ability in the making of money has yet to be realized. But that's an aside. I was about to say that my mother was a reader and a storyteller. My father was a reader too, but he didn't tell the stories so much as listen and nod along. So from small childhood, I was a reader and a listener and a storyteller. Words, words, and words. So today I'm a person who deals in words, but dear God, the words themselves have led me to be suspicious of them. Since 1971, when I left university teaching, a traitor to my class, as a young assistant professor passed on for tenure, I've been very suspicious of words. Deeds, not creeds, remember? So I came back to Manhattan, where I grew up, and settled on a farm southeast of town, married a native woman for whom words were decidedly secondary to almost anything, as when we'd go somewhere to a party or something, and on the way home, we'd talk about the people there, and I would remember what people said, their words, while June would say, "Did you notice his teeth?" Not a dentist, this lady, but an artist and a person who notices visual details acutely, even as she literally doesn't know right from left. "Turn left, turn left," she commands. "Turn left, turn left," she commands from her passenger control seat while pointing to the right. Let's try to get it straight there, Charlie. But that's an aside, too. I was going to read this poem somewhere in here in order to demonstrate how affected I am by words as opposed to teeth or anything in the material world. Here's the poem. 5 lines. "From my mother's sleep, I fell into the state, and I hunched in its belly till my wet fur froze. 6 miles from earth, loosed from the dream of life, I woke to black flak and the nightmare fighters. When I died, they washed me out of the turret with a hose." Well, it's a sad little poem by old Randall Jarrell, who in 1965 fell, or may have caused himself to fall, into a car as he walked along the road one evening in North Carolina, and died, much as his famous ball turret gunner did in World War II 20 years before. And since words make thought, Whorfian hypothesis, you know, and thoughts are the prisoner of words, okay, so that's another aside, I came to believe that that wonderful and sad little poem was the capstone of our sad little Western literature. And I left the world word, the word word, I left the word world and became by turns a pig farmer, a handyman, a carpenter, and a house painter. And then finally, again a traitor to my class, I became a professional memoirist. And that's not an aside. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Charlie. All right. Well, now is the time. Well, I get to read a poem first because I want to, too. And then we'll have some time for discussion and then some closing words. And the poem, I have my collection up here because I couldn't decide which one I wanted to have. I just stood there in front of my bookshelves. I have way too many and saw way too many books, but I thought, okay, I'm going to read a poem that really touched me because after watching the movie Il Postino, if any of you have had a chance to see that, I bought this book of Pablo Neruda's poetry. And the thing that was beautiful to me is someone who could take the art of being in love and to make it universal. I'm sorry, it's not on the right page. I got carried away and started looking at a bunch of others. So pardon me for a moment while I take a look. Oh, it's because I picked up the wrong book. See, can we have a 13-minute erasure on the tape there? Okay. So the poetry of Pablo Neruda, which is, of course, in Spanish, but I'll read it in English. "In you, the earth, little rose, roselit, at times tiny and naked. It seems as though you would fit in one of my hands, as though I'll clasp you like this and carry you to my mouth. But suddenly my feet touch your feet and my mouth your lips. You have grown. Your shoulders rise like two hills. Your breasts wander over my breast. My arm scarcely manages to encircle the thin new moon line of your waist. In love, you have loosened yourself like seawater. I can scarcely measure the sky's most spacious eyes, and I lean down to your mouth to kiss the earth. And now, I would like to hear from you, your questions to any of our speakers today, or books that you are, pieces of literature that you are passionate about. And please use the microphone.
I was just scratching my head, but I did come prepared, just in case the opportunity should arise. I read this first in 1959. It was in the first chapter of the Beginning Economics textbook by Paul Samuelson, and it was from John Maynard Keynes, a British economist born in the late 19th century and died in the middle of the 20th century. Oft cited. The ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. Madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribbler of a few years back. And 2 years later, after a few more courses in economics, I took the senior level course in macroeconomics, and the assigned text for it was a conventional textbook, but we read The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money by John Maynard Keynes. And shortly after I graduated, this had a lot of influence for me, really. This is something I've heard, read, and seen over and over, quoted and misquoted over the years. And shortly after I graduated and joined the world of grown-ups, often I would meet old men in their 50s and 60s, and they would find out that I had majored in economics, and often the question would be, "Are you a Keynesian?" Well, I knew I was in for trouble because the proper pronunciation is Keynesian, and it was almost always from somebody who thought that Keynes was was the handmaiden, of the devil. And as time went on, I learned more, and that Keynes was greatly disliked by both the liberals, the ultra-liberals, the socialists, and the ultra-conservative. So I figured right there he probably was on the right track if nobody liked him, or if people of both extremes did. And I'll get to the major point here of this. I thought that the way to make the world a better place was to have more people understand economics, and that if more of them did, they would make better decisions and the world would work in a better way. And so I committed myself to being a teacher, hoping that my reach would go far. I think it maybe went to about 1 out of 10 students that had some effect. And anyway, John Maynard Keynes, for me, a great hero.
I was amazing that you talked about Fahrenheit 451, because I've seen the movie before I read the book, and I was kind of impressed with the woman standing in the... Does anybody ever not read the book? I don't want to be no spoilers or anything, but she was standing in the on the top of the books, and they were like waiting, as getting ready to light the match, and she lit one, and she dropped it, and she stood right in the middle of the books while they were burning around her and all that, and that kind of had a profound effect on me. And also the very end of it, in the movie, where they were reciting books by memory. And that book had a lot of influence on me because I don't throw away books. I either give them away or I get them repaired or something, but I just don't throw them away, even if I don't like them. So. And the other book I read, which was on, it was in Virginia State University, Malcolm X's autobiography, because the teacher says, okay, we're going to do a book review on Malcolm X's autobiography. And I said, oh, man. He said, don't worry, Miss Boker, you will like it. And I was very impressed with Malcolm X's intelligence. So I wrote a book, a paper called Malcolm X the Scholar, which he kept. But I got an A+ on it, so that was real good. But, yeah, it's like it's amazing how you see something in the media and then what the person was really like. So I was impressed with that book, too. So
On the subject of Caine, Michael Caine is one of the best writers I've ever read. You might look up his autobiography. They have it at the Manhattan Public Library.
Thank you. Contrary to a delivery of a book about Thomas Jefferson in this room, who portrayed him as a very vicious man, I have read a book, a biography of Thomas Jefferson by Meacham, and actually he's turned out to be quite a hero to me. He is the one who was chosen by all his fellow Americans, American leaders, as the genius to write our preamble and our Constitution, and which he did. He also became a marvelous president. He happened to be an aristocrat, but he was extremely well educated, and he was interested in many things, including science and art and horticulture and many things. And throughout his career, he had many, many illnesses. He had headaches that were so bad that he couldn't function. He couldn't think. He had also arthritis. And when his wife died, he almost went, became deranged. When his wife died, he had to move all the time. And he would ride his horse like mad, or he would pace the floor back and forth. And he had a lot of feeling towards a lot of things. He helped us get the Louisiana Purchase. He fought the Tories who wanted to maintain the England as our ruler. And many other things. I just can't name them all.
That was by Meacham.
But what?
Biography by Meacham. Meecham.
I didn't hear.
By Meacham.
Meacham.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. Well, thank
and
you.
And I just want to add that not only the Louisiana Purchase, but he held our nation together and made it the wonderful nation with wonderful ideas. And by the way, Fareed Zachariah this morning recommended a book called America. And it's all about the idea of our country, the genius ideas about it. But anyway, and the only thing that a lot of times they emphasize is when they take tours of Monticello. Okay. And, and mention his...
I'm sorry, we're going to have to...
His black mate, which he legitimized and had a child by. But the main thing I wanted to say is that he worked many hours, many days on trying to get the legislature to ban slavery. And he never believed that he always believed it was a moral question and it wasn't right.
So thank you.
That's a different view of Thomas Jefferson. Okay.
Thank you. All right. We have for closing words, I wanted to share with you a poem from Emily Dickinson. I think it fits with what all of us have shared today. I'm sorry. My closing words. Thanks, Michael. He ate and drank the precious words. His spirit grew robust. He knew no more that he was poor, nor that his frame was dust. He danced along the dingy days, and this bequest of wings was but a book. What liberty a loosened spirit brings. And please join us for our closing hymn, number 326, Let All the Beauty We Have Known. Thank you. We go in friendship and knowledge.